Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for September 3rd, 2023, although the clock strikes midnight as we start this show, at least on the East Coast. So it is September 4th right now. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks, where I tweet it throughout All Out and most other major WWE and AEW events. And All Out tonight had a lot working against it. It was the CM Punk news that put a damper on things this week. It was shown live in Chicago, where obviously that was going to be a particular challenge because of the Punk news. But AEW came out of it with arguably their best pay-per-view ever. I say arguably because I'm not sure that I believe that. I'm still trying to digest that, the show that we just watched. But I think it's in the conversation for certainly the upper echelon of AEW pay-per-views up and down the card. I didn't think there was really anything that was bad, nothing that was even really I can point to as a weak part of the show. There was a lot good on this show. And to join me breaking down this show is PWTorch.com contributor Tony Donofrio. Tony, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight.
Always happy to be here. Pleased to be back. I'd have to agree with you that from an in-ring perspective, this was a very, very good professional wrestling show. If we're going to say it's best ever in terms of in-ring, you can make that argument. I don't know if it's best ever in terms of, you know, the build and how everything played out in the end, but you got a good argument when you talk about just in-ring work from start to finish, though. Excellent show, for sure.
I do see a lot of people online already giving the wrestlers and AEW themselves a lot of, let's call it, extra credit for putting on a show this good in light of the circumstances with the controversy around Punk as the black cloud hanging over the company. Do you give AEW sort of an extra bump in terms of, I guess, if you were scoring this pay-per-view, do you give them extra credit because of the circumstances and how it felt like everybody just was coming together to put on the best show they could so that people were talking about All Out coming out of this weekend instead of CM Punk?
I don't know that I'd give them extra credit per se, but if you're someone that follows this product regularly and you're really into it, you had to think that, you know, as of last night and going into the show today, that if you're on the card today, that you were going to, not that you always don't try and work really hard, but you're going to put a little bit extra in to say, you know what, there's been nothing but people kicking us around for the last 7-8 days. Let's make this show something special, especially when everyone's kind of doubting us. And maybe some of that original 2019 AEW personality or attitude coming out that's like, hey, the whole world thinks we're trending down. We just lost our quote-unquote biggest star. You know, let's go out, work extra hard, give them something extra special in the ring. So extra credit, I'm not so sure. But in terms of, you know, I could have seen something where there was maybe a rallying cry around this pay-per-view in the locker room saying, hey, let's go out there and put on a hell of a show and let's get everybody, to your point, which you said earlier, something to talk about other than CM Punk coming out of the show. And to their credit, I think they did a great job of that.
We're going to have former PW Torch columnist and PWTorch.com contributor Eric Kroll calling in. He was there live at the Allstate Arena tonight for this show. And by the way, if you are listening live on PWTorchDailyCast.com, you are welcome to call in and share your thoughts about All Out, 515-605-9345, or you can email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. But one of the things I want to ask Eric, certainly the top of the list of things that I want to ask him in terms of being there live, Tony, is the reaction of the crowd. I think there may have been a little hesitancy from fans watching at home, kind of wondering how this crowd would react to a CM Punk-less pay-per-view and to a CM Punk-less AEW. And I think they're, you know, a little trepidation perhaps within AEW about that. Was the crowd going to try to take over this show? The good news is they did the show in the same building the night before, and there didn't seem to be any sort of uprising to that level. But there wasn't even here. I mean, even the Young Bucks, who if the crowd was going to turn on anyone, it would be the Bucks. And even they got what seemed to be a mixed reaction, sometimes a little more negative at times than others. But were you surprised at the crowd being more pro-AEW than pro-CM Punk?
Maybe a little bit, but that Chicago crowd has almost been like, and I think Tony Khan even calls it like a second home for AEW, you know, with Jacksonville being its first home. You know, I mean, for the first 2 years in AEW, CM Punk was not a part of Chicago being that second home. And 2 years later, here we are, and it's still going to be their second home. I believe Tony Khan, I think he has family there. So he goes back there every year for Thanksgiving. So we're still going to get that Thanksgiving show. We're still going to get All Out being in Chicago, and they love to run that market. So with or without CM Punk, that's going to be their second home. So, I mean, I was a little bit surprised, but again, Chicago's been such a big part of this company's short history that I guess, you know, if you're a fan of the company, you know, from what I understand, you know, Tony Khan addressed the crowd live last night. I'm sure a lot of people heard about that. He put out the public statement on Collision as well. You know, it was almost like the old Paul Heyman thing where he just went out, was honest with the crowd on why he had to do what he had to do. And, you know, to the most of, I'd say 90%, maybe 80%, whatever you want to call it, of that Chicago crowd, they respected what Tony Khan did and had to say, and they didn't hijack the show. So a large part of that crowd and, you know, fan base, you got to commend. So I was slightly surprised, but I respect them for not just taking over the show.
We've got on the line right now a longtime PWTorch.com contributor, Javier Machado. Javier, happy to have you along as well to kind of share in this conversation here tonight. You know, I'll ask you the same question I did Tony in terms of the quality of this show, where it ranks perhaps in your mind amongst other AEW pay-per-views, which have been largely well-received, and whether or not AEW deserves a little bit of extra credit for not only putting on a really good show, but putting on a really good show in light of the circumstances of things that went down this week.
Hello, Greg. Hello, Tony. Yeah, that's a difficult question for me to answer. Well, one thing, I started late, so I started watching it from the Ruby Soho Chris Lander match. So I missed whatever happened beforehand. I got to catch up on that. But I don't necessarily give AEW extra credit, the company, because this was a mess of their own making. So I'm not going to give them, you know, extra credit for, you know, digging themselves out. I will give the credit to the wrestlers, though, because it seemed like they were really engaged in giving, you know, more than what you would – more than what they would normally do. In terms of how it compares to other shows, I think, you know, if you're just comparing, like, the in-ring wrestling – It is up there, but I see it more holistically as, like, how do you move, you know, how does this move the history of AEW in the, you know, in the aggregate forwards? And the thing is that when, you know, I do the primers for AEW and WWE, and this one was difficult to write because a lot of the stuff was last minute. A lot of the stuff was like very ROH intensive with the Samoa Joe. You know, I think there were more ROH titles defended, or at least the same number of titles, AEW titles defended. You know, your main event was for the international title and stuff like that. So from that respect, I put it like an okay show in terms of like the in-ring action that we saw. Like I said, the wrestlers were very motivated. And the thing is that they also picked up the clip of the show. It was just one match after another. I don't think that the crowd had time to turn on AEW because it was just bang, 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 you know, one match after the other, nobody catching their, you know, no chance for anybody to catch their breath.
Yeah, for sure. It was certainly, you know, you compare the pace of an AEW show, even though it went, you know, as long as it did, 3.5 hours rather, you know, starting from the start of the official pay-per-view, and WWE show, you know, just the other night, Payback ran just over 3 hours, but that was 6 matches, and AEW got 10 matches in because they didn't have, they had video packages, but they were certainly not as long and as drawn out as we see with WWE, and of course, you know, Peacock inserting their ads in there for those who don't have Peacock Premium, so I'm sure that's something that Peacock has insisted on wanting to do as well. So the reaction to the card itself, Tony, what are the matches, you know, thinking back, that stood out to you in particular on this show?
It's funny because, like you said, 10 matches, and they cram so many matches into 3.5 hours. And don't get me wrong, you're getting a lot of bang for your buck, and it's every time. And you shouldn't be surprised, especially if you're a regular viewer of AEW pay-per-views. I mean, you got to go back. The first match is, there was no doubt in my mind that MJF and Cole were going to retain, but that one sticks out to me. I really enjoyed Miro and Powerhouse Hobbs. We got the surprise of CJ Perry showing up, and then they even left a little bit of a cliffhanger on that. So that kudos to them with some, you know, storytelling to look forward to this week with that. And then, like I'd say, the main event was also, those would be my top three matches. The main event, I would say it over-delivered. I mean, I think we all agree that the card as a whole over-delivered just because of their backs being against the wall. And much to Javier's point, they created that problem themselves. But, you know, the roster pulled through. But for me, those were probably the top three matches, and especially that main event. It over-delivered. I knew it was going to be good. But you got to give Orange Cassidy and Moxley a lot of credit for being able to, you know, pull off a main event with the AEW International title, which at one time we all thought was a laughing stock, and now it's the second most important title in that company. And, you know, on a quick note, I'll even say, and I think, I don't know if Javier is a college wrestling or a college football fan. I know you are, Greg, but everyone laughed at Tony Khan a couple years or a year and a half ago, whenever it was, when he debuted this title as the All-Atlantic title. And now, you know, you got college football with the Atlantic Coast Conference having teams in Texas and in the West Coast. So we all laughed at Tony Khan, but he was kind of ahead of the curve with this bi-coastal Atlantic, all Atlantic thing. So just a little thing I thought I'd throw in there, but those were my top three matches, you know, got a little off track there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a good point. I look at Mox Cassidy. I thought that was a really strong match. Takeshita Omega, I thought was really good. Danielson Starks, I mean, Ricky Starks went out there to take a beating, and he succeeded. I mean, he took a hell of a beating from Bryan Danielson. But I think there was, you know, Starks needed something to put him over the top. You know, this was the match people were kind of circling that were like, okay, Ricky Starks has been on the cusp for a long time. What does he need to do to get him over that hump? And maybe taking the beating of a lifetime from Bryan Danielson will do that. I don't know. I mean, a lot of it's going to be in the follow-up. But those are the three matches that really stood out to me. Javier, I know you joined the show about halfway through. You talk about joining at the Statlander match. I actually thought the women's match was really good. I didn't have really high expectations for Statlander versus Soho, but I thought they put on a really solid match. But what were the matches in particular that stood out for you, maybe above and beyond some of the others?
Yeah, the strap match for me was the number one. That was just it was violent. It was violent, like on a you know, for some reason I think their version, because their versions of strap matches have been my favorite, because the one that Punk had was also one match I liked a lot. I think Cody had one too, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so I like them because the violence level was like off the chart. And it was, I mean, and it felt painful. I was wincing throughout it. I thought that the way that, I mean, it's going to sound weird, but the way that Danielson bled, you know, like only half of his face, I thought it was a striking image. And kudos
and
to...
Part of it, Javier, too, is it's so different from WWE strap matches, right? WWE strap matches are a lot like the company itself. It's very sanitized. The focus is more on touching the corners and not necessarily the violence of the strap. And so, yes, this was a good match in a vacuum, but when you compare it to the strap matches that we're used to getting in professional wrestling over the last 20 years through WWE, I mean, it just felt so different.
Yeah, and the choking with the strap, that's another big one. Which it almost felt like it was Danielson getting the monkey off his back when he got fired for choking what's his name?
Justin Roberts.
During his right, yeah. So that had crossed my mind. I do have to give kudos to. I would assume it was one of the cameramen who pointed out the shot because he was in position for the shot. But there's a shot during that match where they film in between the turnbuckles, and the turnbuckle was, like, dripping in blood.
Oh,
did you catch that? You know,
that was awesome.
A great, you know, and you see through the turnbuckle, dripping, and, you know, it at starts, that was some great camera work for a company that you know, lately has been, you know, there have been some criticisms where they've missed some important shots. And I thought that was a great moment with the camera. Unfortunately, I think right after that, they cut to a fan in the audience, which is like my biggest bugaboo. So, but that was a great moment.
One of the big things, controversies, I guess, going into this show was MJF and Adam Cole. You know, they win the ROH tag titles at All In. They're defending them. And as it turned out on the first match of this show, I think all is forgiven because the quality of the show itself was just so high. But what do we think, Tony, I'll start with you, about MJF and Adam Cole on a, you know, you're asking people to pay $50 for a lineup ahead of time, right? And I think that's where the criticism had come in. Certainly the criticism isn't going to be levied against the quality of the show. But you're asking people to pay $50 for a lineup, and you've got MJF, your world champion, in a match against the Dark Order for the ROH titles. I mean, ROH tag titles. You know, so I think there was some frustration there from fans who were like, you know, wait a minute, this is a $50 show. You know, that's a strange move.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start. With the first thing I think is, like I said earlier, I really enjoyed that match. I thought it was well put together. Having said that, it almost felt like it was just a way to get them on the show because, I mean, how many people, let's be honest, really care about the Ring of Honor tag team titles? Not many. That's the first thing. Second thing, they have this sort of, I mean, not even sort of, they have this, you know, story going right now with Roderick Strong and the Kingdom. And then the Kingdom wasn't even in the Battle Royal to earn a spot on the card, which seemed like the obvious choice. That didn't happen. Then the biggest thing for me was the post-match. The post-match caught me off guard, and it's not like I hated it once all was said and done because he got into the scrap with Samoa Joe, which leads me to believe that there's going to be a thread there for, you know, MJF and Samoa Joe to have a feud coming up here. But the first thing I thought is after that match, when it ended, you know, Adam Cole grabbed the title and he had it slung over his shoulder. I was waiting for MJF to freak out on Cole. And instead, you know, we get the interaction with him and Samoa Joe. So the whole thing just seems kind of weird and a little bit disconnected because it seems like the next big thing is going to be Cole and the Kingdom and the fallout with him and MJF still from All In looming. You know, on live television, and then instead you got something with Samoa Joe. So I'm not sure. It seems like they had a focused direction, and now they've kind of splintered MJF off into this feud now that looks like it's going to head towards Samoa Joe. So the whole, even though I enjoyed that match and I thought, you know, Adam Cole worked really well in it, especially because he worked most of the match by himself, I enjoyed the match, but the post-match left me kind of confused because it seems like you had a direction and now you're taking it another way. And I'm curious to see and if they're going to put these threads together in any way, but it kind of caught me off guard.
Well, let's go now to longtime PW Torch columnist, current PWTorch.com contributor, Eric Kroll, who was there live at the Allstate Arena for All Out and willing to call in and give us a live perspective of the show. Eric, thanks so much for joining us here tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you. You know, I guess the first question, and I had already talked about this with Tony and Javier, the first question that I have that I'm really interested in is the crowd in terms of the Punk news, because I think, you know, it was there were a lot of eyes and ears on this crowd wondering how they would react to the CM Punk news that happened this week. Would they be a crowd that was more pro AEW? Would they try to hijack the show? Would there be lots of CM Punk chants? So, you know, overall, I know that the Young Bucks being in a match kind of set them on edge a little bit, but what was your reaction to the crowd's reaction in terms of CM Punk? It seemed to be, from watching it on TV, a more pro AEW crowd than necessarily a pro CM Punk crowd.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I was there last night where there was about 4,000 people in a big basketball arena that seats 13, 14,000 for wrestling with a big stage set up. And Tony Khan came out and he got drowned in booze, right? It did about 5.5 minutes. And, people who were there were not happy. He won them over a little bit at times when he started throwing about nostalgia and the first All In, and boy, we set a record at the second All In, and so I was curious to see. But he really, really, last night and so the crowd really wasn't really doing a lot of CM Punk chants after that, right? They got it out of their system. So tonight I kept waiting. Where are the CM Punk chants? Even before the matches started, and they never came until the Young Bucks came. Right, but they got booed out. They got drowned out by boos, and I was really surprised. I assumed the people who didn't get to get it out of their system last night, you know, there were more than twice as many people there tonight, about at least 9,500. And I thought they would be booing, but they didn't. They were more pro AEW. Very, very surprising to me.
Yeah, me too, but a good sign for AEW moving forward for sure. So I'll ask you about the show as a whole. It seems to be that this show is getting overwhelming praise, at least from people that I've seen online. I know from being in shows in the crowd live that the live experience tends to inflate the quality of the show. So I doubt that you have a different opinion, but just from being there live, I mean – where does this rank in terms of, like, if you were to, I guess, split AEW pay-per-views up into tiers? Does this make the upper tier of AEW pay-per-views?
Not for me, it doesn't. It was, you know, one of the weaker AEW pay-per-views I've been to on paper going in, and I felt like this show was backloaded. Once they got to the strap match, they had heat the whole rest of the way, right? The crowd really didn't take a break. That's probably because they were fairly well rested from the opening five matches. The only, you know, they really liked the opener with I am not a fan of the Cole MJF storyline. It's too NXT for me. Don't like the skits. Don't like the goofy WWE style, you know, spots in the match. Crowd was up for that. Crowd is eating it up. I acknowledge I am in the minority on that one. And then things were kind of dead. And this year, it seems like the last 2 years, the crowd in Chicago picks a match to go into business for itself. Last year, it was the Acclaimed with the Oh, Scissor Me Daddy chants that really got the Acclaimed over. And this year, it was Miro and Powerhouse Hobbs. The crowd just entertained itself by, you know, various chants, beat your meat. just all sorts of meat puns. And I thought that match came across very slow and kind of plodding. Like, I wouldn't call it like Warlord versus Hercules in a 1988 WWE house show, but because it was better than that. But it just, without the crowd getting into it, you know, I think the crowd probably adds a half star to a star on that match. So yeah, it was a tale of two cards for me. One of the interesting things is the, as usually happens at an AEW show, all the guys start heading for the restroom and concession stands when the women's match is announced and about to start. And they had a hard time getting the crowd into it. And then they just kept doing stuff. And the crowd was finally into it, you know, by the time they reached a peak. But, how did the card come across on TV? Better than I'm making it sound live?
A little bit. I agreed totally with you. In fact, I tweeted this out that Statlander and Soho seemed to get the crowd by the end. So that was good to see because I thought they worked hard and I thought they put on a pretty good match there, especially as you mentioned toward the end. I'm being joined by two PWTorch.com contributors, Tony Donofrio and Javier Machado. So I'm going to let you guys ask any questions of Eric that you have of him being in a live crowd. Tony, if you've got a question for Eric, go ahead.
I'm trying to think if there's anything off the top of my head. Not really. I know we had talked that – I know Greg and I had a slight disagreement. I feel like you were more on my side of things where, I don't know, Greg really believes that this pay-per-view was one of the better AEW pay-per-views in its short history. And where I disagreed with him was that, you know, that from an in-ring perspective, I thought that the match over – you know, it went above and beyond what we expected, but would you agree that, you know, considering the build up and the hype for this show, that the card, at least tonight, did overexceed your expectations? And what did you think? Do you think maybe the wrestlers worked even extra hard tonight than they normally did to try to put the CM Punk news to bed, or at least to try to hide that? Because Greg and I seem to have a slight disagreement on that, but that's where I fell on one side and he fell on the other. That, you know, for me, it was a great in-ring card, but I still wouldn't have put it as the upper tier where it was one of the – I'd say it was one of the best AEW pay-per-views since it's, you know, in its four-year history.
I attended Dynamite on Wednesday and the Rampage taping after, and then I was at Collision yesterday. So I had very low expectations going into the show. So the show exceeded my expectations. But for me, you know, Chicago is such a home base for that promotion that I got to see the Young Bucks Lucha Brothers cage match, you know, the first All Out, the third All Out, I think, and Forbidden Door 1. I got to be there for Revolution in February 2020, right before the lockdowns pandemic set in, and got to see the Hangman Page and Kenny Omega versus the Bucks tag title match. So for me, I've seen a lot of really good AEW shows, and I went to see my favorite Hangman Page win the title in Minneapolis with Wade and Todd Martin in November, whatever that was. 21 probably. So I feel like I've seen a ton of really good AEW pay-per-views and watched a bunch of really good ones at home on pay-per-view. And so when the first half of the card is, I guess maybe your mileage varies on how much you like the MJF Adam Cole thing. Cause to me, the pre-show was not great. The first few matches, you know, first half of the card really didn't do that much for me. So that's why I'm putting it in the lower tier. But, you know, the strap match obviously delivered. The Kenny Tatesta match really delivered. Have you guys talked about kind of the feels going over more than you might have expected tonight? I was surprised Kenny took the loss. I guess in the eight-man tag that it was this was Cash Wheeler's penalty for the gun charges, right? He did the job in that match, which, you know, anybody but Jay White on the heel team could have done the job. And then I think there was one more where I was surprised. Oh, the Castagnoli and Wheeler Yuta. I assumed Wheeler Yuta was doing the job in that match, and it didn't happen. The heels won, so they were putting a little more heat on the heels maybe than they usually do. I didn't get the sense that people were working hard because they were motivated with Punk gone. I got the sense that these are all just pros who are going to try and deliver in their spots on a pay-per-view.
Javier, anything for Eric?
Eric, did you get the feeling that the crowd went home happy? Because my concern going into the weekend was that a lot of the, we already touched upon it, that there wasn't really much build. It almost felt like the card was almost an afterthought based on, you know, having to get everything together right after All In. And there's been a conversation over the week, maybe the ticket buying audience is going to be, down because, the stuff, we main evented with the international title. At the end of the day, do you think the crowd went home happy with what everything they got?
Yeah, I think so. There was the crowd was up for the last five matches, and usually on a show that started at 6 p.m. Central and didn't end until close to 11 Central, there are times when you're exhausted, but, I thought that tag match with Eddie Kingston and Shibata was going to suffer being a come-down match after the strap match, and it wasn't. Interestingly, I assume this came across this way on TV, crowd did not really treat Jon Moxley like a heel for the most part, right? They were excited when he came into the ring. They popped for the news, the title change, and they went off the air, and Orange Cassidy sold for a really long period of time. Then the Best Friends came out. Crowd started chanting his name, revived him. Best Friends came out, did the hug, and then that was it. No Tony Khan appearance tonight, which I can't say blame him after last night. Better to let that sleeping dog lie.
Yeah, what was the crowd like in terms of merchandise? I know this is a question Wade always likes to ask. Were there a lot of people wearing CM Punk merchandise? Was there any wrestler or group that stood out in terms of people wearing their merchandise at the show?
There were a lot of Punk shirts because, if you're in Chicago and you went to his debut at the United Center a few years ago, you probably got that shirt. The hottest selling item tonight was a miniature version of the cardboard Jay White. it's not the life size, but it's like it's something you can hold in your hand. I would say it's maybe as big as two foam fingers in terms of height. I saw those things when I got in, and I wanted to go see how much they cost just to report on it, and they were all gone. I couldn't find any at the merch stand. There were a decent amount of Acclaim shirts, a lot of Adam Cole Bay Bay shirts, better than you Bay Bay shirts, right? Those seem to be the biggest sellers. Most of the T-shirts were for All Out, or they were, generic AEW shirts. And that was largely the case for all three shows I was at this week. There wasn't, for a company that's supposedly a T-shirt company, it's always disappointing the recent years when you go to these shows and look at the merch stands.
How close to a sellout was it tonight?
So the last figure I saw for WrestleTix was about 9,500. And I think, for basketball, it seats 20,000, 21,000, something like that. For a wrestling show, I want to say Forbidden Door 1 had 13,000 or 14,000 people in the building. So it was two-thirds full, I would say, for you know, the large stage blocked off a bunch of seats on one end of the stadium. So it was, you know, the crowd was a lot louder than last night when there were only 4,000 people in the building, obviously. Yeah, they did good business. The thing to watch for, I think, in the coming weeks and months is people used to buy AEW tickets right away when it was a new thing. Well, it's not the new thing anymore, and their ticket sales tend to pick up late, and they've been doing a lot of deep discounts. I, much to my chagrin, I think our group, with fees, we paid for 16th row of the 100 level, which were good seats. I think we paid $176 each, and yesterday or the day before, I went online and I saw that similar seats, a couple sections over, were going for $20. So, you know, it's what that tells me next year. Floor seats are always going to sell out, right? But people who want the premium seats. But next year, I'm just going to wait, and I'm just going to get a ticket the day of, the day before, and I'm going to pay a lot less. And it's a better deal.
Last question I have for you, Eric, then I'll throw it to Tony and Javier for any last questions they have. What was the match on the show that surprised you most in terms of crowd reaction? A match that got a better reaction than you thought, or maybe not as much of a reaction, or just a different reaction than you thought it would get?
For sure, it was Miro and Powerhouse Hobbs, as we talked about before. Just something about it, two big meaty men flapping meat. The crowd,
that's the Big E quote right there.
Just the crowd went into business for itself, wanted to amuse itself, entertain itself, and they did. And you could tell Miro was getting into it. They were playing to the crowd when the crowd got into it. I don't know how long that match ran, but it ran a heck of a lot longer than I thought it needed to. You know, in a power match like that, you don't want these guys going.
Yeah.
To me, it felt like 15 or 20 minutes, and I don't know that what time it was. I wasn't running a stopwatch, but they did a lot more near falls. But yeah, I didn't expect a lot out of that match going in. You know, it almost feels like a collision top of the hour match, right? Not a pay per view quality match necessarily. And so that for me, that was the surprise match of the night.
Tony, any other questions for Eric before we let him go?
Yeah, I guess just one, because I missed the pre-show, and I'm starting to realize unless there's something I really need to watch that it's not worth it because the shows are long enough.
Welcome to my world, Tony. That's been my feeling for a long time.
What was the crowd reaction like for Rodman? Because I didn't get to see the match. I don't know how well that came off. Did the Chicago crowd still, I mean, I know I got to watch Collision. Didn't seem like it was anything special, but to your point, there was only about 4,000 there last night. Did most people get to their seats for that match? And how was the reaction for the Worm?
Yeah, there were long lines to get in when doors opened at 5. I mean, I think I was in line about 5:10, and I didn't get in the building till 5:45. So, you know, security screening and whatnot. We just in Chicago, we recently, within the last couple of weeks, there was a shooting at a White Sox game where the, I used to be a journalist in Chicago, so I still know some people, and the unreported gossip is that it was a cop who brought in their gun by waving their badge, and it accidentally discharged at their seat. You know, the public sort of still wondering what happened there, and so security was a little tighter in terms of the screening at the gate. So I don't think everybody was in their seat for the Rodman Jarrett six man match. Dennis Rodman remains over in Chicago. The Bulls have not really done much since the end of the Jordan year. There was a Derrick Rose era for a little bit, but he hurt his knee and kind of was never the same. And so.
Right.
Chicagoans do love their championship sports teams because they don't get that many of them anymore, and that was sort of the apex. But the match was you know, the kind of the dog crap you would expect, right? It was, it was goofy. You know, not a fan.
All right, Javier, anything else for Eric from your end?
Eric, yeah, that Miro match, Wade has it clocking in at 16 minutes. That does seem a little bit excessive. Since you saw a bunch of the shows this week, was there any difference in the crowds or pretty much the same kind of crowd, same kind of crowd?
Chicago has a large Latino population and draws a large Latino audience for AEW has. On Wednesday night, Orange got booed because there were only 3,000 or so, between 3,000 and 3,500 people in the now arena, the former Sears Center, the home of the first All In 2018, and the smaller crowds for the two TV tapings were. You could influence the crowd reactions a little bit more by getting, your row and the row behind you to do chants. So, other than that, it was a normal crowd, mostly young men aged 15 to 50, right, for the most part.
beautiful pro wrestling demographic, men 15 to 50. That covers a lot of ground. Eric Kroll, PWTorch.com contributor, thank you so much for joining us tonight and presenting a live perspective of the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
Absolutely. Thank you. All right. A couple other things, guys, that I want to hit on, a couple of the major happenings on this show. Then we'll go to an email we've got. Let's go to the main event, Moxley and Cassidy. To me, this was the perfect cap to Orange Cassidy's international title run, where he really somehow became a pay-per-view main eventer in holding the secondary title of the company. And, you have to go back and study how this exactly happened. But, when you look at his title defenses and every one of them, he kind of lost a piece of himself, right? That was the story. He was getting so beat up and so beat up, and with every title defense that he won, he lost a little bit of himself. And so now he's main eventing a pay-per-view. It's against Jon Moxley, of all people, who is the best situated wrestler to take advantage of someone in Orange Cassidy's physical state at this point. And it just felt like a great coda to Orange Cassidy's reign, where he is greater for having had this reign than he was starting out. So, Tony, can you make any argument for Orange Cassidy retaining here, or was Moxley winning the right move?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say it's that old adage, the title doesn't make the guy, the guy makes the title. First of all, Orange Cassidy has made this title. Because when they, like I said earlier, I made a joke about it. They introduced it, and we all collectively, most people thought the title was a joke. He has gone above and beyond, elevating that title, and it was mentioned on the broadcast tonight. I think it was Nigel McGuinness. It's basically the workhorse title at this point. It's the old school WWF Intercontinental title. And when the Intercontinental title really, really meant something, and that's not to disrespect what Gunther's done to it this past year, but the international title is now the workhorse title, and hopefully that's what it remains. To answer your question, though, what's funny is as the summer went on, you could kind of see, if you're paying attention, reading the tea leaves, that they were going to go towards this Orange Cassidy Moxley match, and I was kind of just resigned myself to the fact that Orange has done everything he can to elevate this title. But it's definitely time for Moxley to win the title. And I was really on board with that until Dynamite and Collision this week, when Orange had that really great promo after the match on Wednesday, putting over how much this title means to him and how it's changed him. And you could see it through his work. You could see it through his actions, the characters developed. And then again, even through the promos that Moxley and Orange Cassidy did last night, like I got to a point where after Dynamite and after Collision last night, I was like, I don't want him to lose the title yet because he's put it over so much and it's changed the trajectory of his character. I think he could do some more with it, and you could even make it bigger if he drops the title at, say, Wrestle Dream or Full Gear. But having said that, I'm not upset with the title change. I know Moxley's a workhorse in, you know, himself. I mean, he even treated the world title like that last summer whenever he was the interim champion. So the title's in good hands with Moxley. I'm not disappointed, but over the last 4 or 5 days, I was convinced that, you know what, if they let Orange Cassidy run with this a couple more months, I would have been perfectly fine with it.
Yeah, Javier, same question to you. The right time, the right opponent to end Cassidy's strong international championship reign?
I mean, I think overall it worked well, but I will give the, you know, counter argument on that because, I mean, Cassidy is almost 40. He's, I think, 39 now. And this probably is the last big, this kind of run that he will have with the title. I think it would have been more to just, it would have been a much, like, cement the legend of this run with him defeating Moxley. And then being somebody else who can use the rub that you have high faith and you don't want to give it to somebody who's, you know, not going to do anything with the title, to be the one who finally defeats him. You know, he's defeated like the top guys, but this wear and tear that he's gotten, it's, you know, some young guy comes in and takes it from him. Very similar. I mean, they essentially almost copy the storyline they're doing with Omega, you know, being taken down by the new hotter model Takeshita. So, you know, a similar kind of thing. I think that I would have done it that way, but without knowing what they're going to do with the Moxley run, you know, I can't, like, you know, I can't say this is bad or the way I would do it would have been better. You know what I mean? Because you could always have, I mean, that if you follow the TNT title, I mean, you know, Darby did restore some luster to the TNT title, but then it went to the whole back and forth with Powerhouse Hobbs and Wardlow and with QT Marshall involved, and it killed it again, which was part of the Darby's motivation to go after the title was that, you know, he made it mean something, now it doesn't mean anything, now he's going to make it mean something again. That was why he went after it. You know, so you could end up with that scenario. So I'm saying that perfect scenario being, you know, someone like, you know, Nick Wayne. I mean, obviously he's probably too young to actually, you know, have a long run, but, you know, Nick, you know, someone like him win it, you know, somebody that you want to push to the next level, maybe Starks, you know, Ricky Starks, wins it from him. I think that would have been better, unless you have something specifically like much better planned out for Mox. But if your thing is like, oh, we're just going to give it to Mox, and Mox will just hold it, and we don't really have any plans for it, then I think this would be a bad call. But until we see, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, with MJF, I mean, doesn't really have a challenger right now. He's defending the ROH tag titles. I think his eventual challenger, CM Punk, has left the building, so they kind of have to regroup and reorganize the main event scene to get an upcoming opponent for MJF. So while that's happening, all of a sudden the international title does take on an added importance. So hopefully, you know, with Moxley as champion, they continue the upward trajectory of the belt and continue the push with it that they had with Orange Cassidy. And so, you know, kind of a same situation with Takeshita and Omega. I was surprised to hear that Eric was surprised that Takeshita won, because I thought that was the pretty clear direction here in their first match, the first singles match, to get Takeshita over. I know that when he first came upon the scene, the big complaint is, wow, here's this big future star who is having all of these great matches, but he never wins. So I think Takeshita in particular was in need of a real signature win as a singles with Don Callis at his side. And maybe you could make the argument, I guess, that, and the announcer said it right after the match, that Kenny Omega has lost quite a bit in singles matches, and maybe he shouldn't be losing as much as he is, because he should be maybe protected a little more than he has been. But, Tony, do you see this as the right decision in terms of having Takeshita go over in this match?
Yeah, absolutely. And to Javier's point, honestly, you mentioned Ricky Starks, and you could have even – I liked your idea, and like I said, I could have even seen something where Orange retained tonight, and then it's so finally destroyed that you could have thrown the random matchup on Wednesday night of Takeshita versus Orange Cassidy, and then because of how beat up he is, Takeshita could have easily beat him in like 3 minutes, and instantly elevate Takeshita even more. But when it comes to tonight, I was not surprised at all. I think it was the right booking call. Kenny Omega losing some matches this year, it's not going to hurt him. I mean, think about, it's almost like he's taking his turn. The first year AEW was around, he wasn't exactly lighting the world on fire. Then the second year, the second full year, you know, right during COVID, he carries the company as champion. Now he's taking a step back again. It wouldn't take much to heat Kenny Omega back up. So Takeshita going over is the right move. And like I said, you know, I feel like the Callis family is going to expand here in the coming weeks. But there's nothing I would have changed about that. And if you ever need to heat up Omega again, it shouldn't be a problem.
Javier, you agree with that? Takeshita going over was the right move there?
Yeah, much for the same reasons. Plus, it's just the story is obviously that Callis basically ran Omega to the ground to get every last, you know, bit. And then once he started sputtering, he's like, okay, here's the new hot model, and trade it up. So, and you're meant to believe that this is Kenny Omega's last, you know, he's done. And I mean, and he sold it very well during the match, because there's a moment the camera focuses in on him near the end. And, you know, the Taz even said, look, his eyes are closed, because he was done at that point. And that was kind of like, you know, he sold that, the realization that, you know, here is a better, you know, this match, the purpose of the match was to show that Takeshita is a better, younger, faster model, the new version, the V2 Kenny Omega. And it established that. Now, I mean, you know, granted, you want now Kenny Omega as the veteran, you know, having to, you know, rebuild himself. Similar to which was the Rocky where he had to rebuild himself, like that. That's the story.
Rocky III. And I was having the same thoughts as you were saying it. I'm thinking he's talking about Rocky III. But go on.
Yeah. They're obsessed with that movie. But yeah, that's the story. That's the story for him going forward. I mean, and I'm just gonna say this is obviously gonna lead up to a Sammy Guevara Takeshita versus former enemies Jericho and Omega, the Winnipeg buddies. That I think is like the direction that this is going to go eventually. So, you know.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We've got Reverend Keith from Baltimore, Maryland, greeting us this evening. Reverend Keith, thanks for staying up late with us tonight here on Wrestling Night in America.
You're quite welcome. It's always a joy to speak with you, Greg, Javier, and Tony. First off, I want to praise the All Elite Wrestling family for putting on what I thought was a very stellar show in spite of all of the controversy that has occurred within the past 24 to 48 hours. Kudos to Tony Khan and company. I mean, to me, this show really exceeded expectations considering the card, considering the storylines, and considering the matches that were lined up. I thought that, you know, they really put on a good four-hour presentation. And what I do want to focus on briefly with the three of you is the fact that in at least half of the matches, gentlemen, the younger or inexperienced talent were put over. Okay, if we go back to Miro and Powerhouse Hobbs, we all know Miro is the former Rusev. You know, he's already been established in the wrestling business. But Powerhouse Hobbs, even in a losing effort, was the one who was put over drastically by him maintaining his heel heat after the match, which brought CJ Perry back. You move forward. I heard you guys bragging about the strap match. Ricky Starks was made in this match. Daniel Bryan beat him to a pulp, but Ricky Starks was made in this match. In the Chris Statlander, Ruby Soho match, Ruby has the most experience. Chris Statlander really has turned her game up a few notches since rehabbing from a torn ACL. And then in the main event, as I tweeted earlier, Orange Cassidy rose to the main event level tonight. I mean, I followed his career even when he, before he became All Elite, when he used to wrestle on IWTV. And all I can say is that I've never seen OC this intense, and Mox brought it out of him. So I think the underlying tone for this card was the fact that a lot of the younger and or inexperienced talent was put over. What are your thoughts on this?
I hadn't looked at it from that point of view, but I can see where you get that from, even in losing efforts, as you said. You know, guys like Powerhouse Hobbs, guys like Ricky Starks, you know, you had Wheeler Yuta as part of the tag team that got the victory over Eddie Kingston and Katsuyori Shibata. You had Takeshita going over Omega, which we talked about. Bullet Club Gold going over the Bucks and FTR. So I would say that would qualify too, if not younger, than at least newer wrestlers in the AEW environment, and I think that counts for something as well. Tony, I'm not sure if it was a conscious decision to put a younger talent or newer talent over, but I think in the AEW environment as it is now, it kind of does feel like maybe a reset is needed with Punk going out the door and maybe just a reshuffling of the deck. So do you think we got that tonight?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat with you. I didn't look at it that way either, but you're right. You didn't get not that it would have been glaring. You didn't, but you don't come out of the show going, oh, it's the same old crap, like we did for a long time with WWE, not so much in the recent year, last year or two. But, yeah, you're right, between the Takeshita and, you know, Hobbs and Statlander, all those are great examples. You're right. And you mentioned Bullet Club Gold, and I mean, this is something maybe we could talk about later if there's time. And it's definitely well past due now. You got to get Jay White into some singles programs. I love what he's doing with Bullet Club Gold, and I'm not even saying that you got to break the group up. But it's time to, you know, especially with Punk out of the fold, he may be the biggest beneficiary now to kind of step into to that role, whether as a heel or a face. It doesn't matter. He's probably going to, I don't see him turning face anytime soon. But a lot of young guys got to shine tonight. And Jay White, he's not some old man. So you could definitely stick him in that group. And I think it's time for him to be thrust to the forefront, because he's a main event talent. And you're kind of wasting them in the tag team mix right now, where you have a tag team in Bullet Club Gold that you could be using, that you could actually, you know, be re-elevating again with the Guns. So, but yeah, definitely, Keith, I would agree that, a lot was done tonight to showcase some other guys that you haven't had a chance to do so much this past summer. And it's very good, good thought on your part.
Yeah, Javier, one way that you elevate young talent is just by having them on the show. And one person who was not on this show, somewhat conspicuous by his absence, is someone who's been on almost every other AEW pay-per-view, if not every other AEW pay-per-view, and that being Chris Jericho. And him not being on the show and, you know, making an opportunity for someone younger to be on that show, I think is kind of an example of what Reverend Keith is talking about, you know, pushing younger guys by omission, in this case, omitting a veteran who's been around the block in Chris Jericho.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I got the – it felt like Jericho, the Jericho-Sammy plus the I forgot who the wrestler. They're teaming together against somebody. That felt like it was a match that would have gone to this pay-per-view if it wasn't like making it 11 on the main card and it's going to be on Dynamite. So it almost felt like it was the one that made the cut, similar how the Trish and Becky one got cut from SummerSlam. That was like my impression, because I was like, oh, you know, I did strike me that, oh, you know, because they did promote the match for Dynamite, and I'm like, oh, that's right, that Jericho's not on this card. So yeah, I was surprised by that, but I mean, on the, you know, I'll say that Jericho does the people, you know, a lot of cases he is wrestling with other younger talent around him to, you know, get the rub while also, you know, maintaining his stature too. So, you know, give and take there. So, you know, he's helped Sammy and some other people. So, but yeah, I mean, when you do have, you know, you had the eight man basically took off a lot of people that would have a singles match out to give some space for some other people to have a shot.
Reverend Keith, back to you for your next question or comment for us.
And to end Javier's speculation, the match is Jericho and Sammy versus Aussie Open Wednesday night.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. Last but not least, we have a few stories emanating out of this pay-per-view. You have, of course, the odd situation between Miro and his wife, CJ Perry, because he wasn't too happy that she came and made the save for him. And you also have undoubtedly an impending story between Ricky Starks and Big Bill. Now, if you go back and watch the match, okay, when Ricky Starks came and jumped off the rope, he seemed like he was trying to stop Big Bill from chokeslamming Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, and he ended up, you know, knocking him over. Now, the commentators were kind of quiet. They kind of laid out on that, but that's a question in my mind. Will Ricky Starks go back to being a babyface? Because if you go back to Collision last night, he cut a babyface promo before calling Ricky Steamboat out and was tricked into, you know, the Dragon name on the contract, and then that brought out Bryan Danielson. But that was a phenomenal babyface promo that Ricky Starks cut at the beginning of that segment last night. And then last but not least, you know, when and will Don Callis add to his family? Because you know, by them promoting Takeshita tonight, they're going to need somebody to surround him, you know, in that family. And also, which title will Jay White go towards? So thank you for taking my call. Thank you for staying up late. As always, it's good talking to you. Have a blessed week, gentlemen.
Thank you, as always, for your participation, Reverend Keith. Really appreciate it, and the topics that you brought up tonight. Javier, I'll start with you in terms of Ricky Starks as a babyface. Certainly, there is an opportunity after the beating he took tonight from Bryan Danielson for him to appear as a babyface next. He was really negative on Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. And I feel like if you were planning to turn him babyface, I don't know if you would have gone that heavy in that direction. But I do feel like Ricky Starks has just a lot of babyface fire on the mic. And that's really, you know, I thought they kind of dropped the ball when they had turned him babyface originally. And he did seem to have a lot of momentum for a very short period of time. And it didn't seem like they capitalized on that. So do you think at this point a babyface turn for him is the right move?
I like him better as a babyface. They should not have turned him. I also don't like the idea of turning people back and forth. So I'm kind of like ambivalent over it. I'm fine if they do, and then they just, you know, promote him that way. I even missed exactly how that Big Bill thing happened, just because I was seeing red at that moment, because that happened like right after a part of the match where they got into the Japanese style, you know, chop fest or strike fest, except they were doing it with the straps, and the crowd had gotten off their feet, and the crowd was molten for that segment. And then you get the outside interference, and that felt like you just hit the brakes on the match at that point. Had the match from that point had just, you know, they would have sold what they, you know, both down, they would have sold, and then you would have just gone the sprint to the end. This would have, I would have, you know, this would have been even better in my estimation. But once you introduce the whole Big Bill, and the only reason they introduced Big Bill is so that Rig and Dragon Steamboat could get his moment in because he was involved. I would not have done that because I think that ended up this was subtraction by addition, and I thought that was a bad moment. And I was seeing red at that moment, so like at that point I didn't care what was going on outside. so that was my take on that moment in the match, and so I don't know. I didn't take away from the previous night that it was, I mean, it was a baby face style type promo, not necessarily the content. And, you know, he basically wanted to whip an old man. And I don't know if I would consider that a baby face.
Right. That's where I think the turn would be hard at this moment. Like if you wanted to do it 2 or 3 months from now, when that is firmly in the rearview mirror for a lot of fans, maybe you could get away with it. But so soon after that, I think it would be a struggle. Tony, you know,
well,
and
the other thing is that during the match, he does tell Steamboat, Starks does. He goes, this could have, you know, as he's whipping Danielson, he turns to Steamboat and tells him, this could have been you. Which, I mean, he should have said this should have been you, because, yeah, it could have been you. That is why we tricked you. So it wasn't me. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's still going after Steamboat at that point. So, I think it's just he lends himself to being a babyface. So you're wanting that.
Yeah. How hard, Tony, do you think it would be to turn Ricky Starks babyface after a loss? You know, we've seen babyfaces turn, you know, heels turn babyface after they get beat up, and it doesn't always take. I mean, do you think Starks could conceivably, if they wanted to go that direction, do you think they could turn him babyface based off the match tonight?
You could, and I think the heel turn was ill-conceived as it was. I agree. I wouldn't have turned him heel back at the end of the Owen Hart Cup tournament. You know, 3 weeks ago, though, he cut a promo in between the time when they knew where they were going to bring Steamboat back, and it came off as a babyface promo on Collision. For me, he just lends himself better, and it's hard to believe because he's a great heel. He is a great heel. At least he was, you know, back in the Team Taz days and coming out of that. But he is AEW's version of Becky Lynch. It's almost like he was turned heel at a time when he shouldn't have been, much like Becky was like 3-4 years back. And the crowd doesn't want to boo him. So you could easily turn him back. Maybe you just ride the wave and see what happens. That's kind of what WWE did with Becky Lynch before she had her big babyface run that led up to her main eventing, you know, WrestleMania. That might just be a case of, let's let him do what he's going to do the next 2-3 months. If the crowd turns them back babyface, just go with it. But I agree with you, Javier. I'm not a fan of somebody turning babyface heel 3-4 times in a year, you know, and turning them into the modern day Big Show. We don't need that again. But I would just kind of let him be himself the next 2 or 3 months, lean him heel. But if the crowd still wants to cheer him, slowly mold him back, let him just ease back into the babyface mode, because it seems like, I said before, it seems like he's AEW's version of Becky Lynch at this point, where as good of a heel as that person can be, they don't lend themselves, the crowd does not want to boo them. The crowd would much rather get behind them.
The other question Reverend Keith had was about the next Don Callis family member. We saw the situation with Chris Jericho, where Callis didn't believe Jericho was going to join, so he painted a very negative picture of Chris Jericho, or had it commissioned for him. So the Don Callis family is still lacking another member besides Konosuke Takeshita. Tony, do you have any inkling of who that could be? Or maybe a better question is who that should be? Anyone on the AEW roster that you believe would benefit from being a part of the Don Callis family?
I mean, unless they plan on swerving us, which they kind of did with Jericho, because initially I thought Jericho was going to go that way, and now I don't know what the heck they're doing with it. But now it seems to be the next guy is going to be Sammy, unless that's another swerve coming our way. But, I mean, it seems to me like, you know, usually when you're building a faction, you want to have one guy that's standalone at the top. It seems like Takeshita, I am having a hell of a time saying his name tonight. I don't know why. It seems like Takeshita,
though,
is going to be the – oh, God. I know, right? And I rag on him, like, from my TV, like, what the hell are you saying? And here I am tonight, so maybe I need to lay off a little. But anyways, Takeshita obviously is the – it seems like he's going to be the leader in terms of the in-ring talent. So – I don't know. You would think Sammy Guevara would be that guy, but does Sammy want to be the second to someone again in a group? I mean, not that it's his call. Sammy seems like the choice they're going with, but maybe it's the swerve is it ends up being Daniel Garcia, someone like that. So other than that, I can't think of any names off the top of my head. I mean, like I said, there's already guys that are in groups that make sense. So I would say Guevara and maybe Garcia being my dark horse.
Javier, what do you think about the idea of Sammy Guevara joining Don Callis' family? Do you think that's a good fit or no?
Well, I mean, that's what I mentioned earlier, was that eventually we're going to get Sammy and Konosuke versus Jericho. Now, I don't know if Sammy necessarily joins the family or if they do what they've been doing with the with Callis, that he's been aligning himself with other factions, first with the Blackpool Combat Club and then with Bullet Club Gold. So, so I don't know if it's going to be just an alliance between Takeshita and Sammy to take on the Winnipeg brothers, or if it's going to be, him formally joining as part of the family. I mean, I wouldn't, I don't see Sammy as the – you still need somebody to take the falls, because I don't think – I wouldn't put Sammy as the guy to take the fall in that group. I don't see him as main event material, but he would be the member of the faction that's going after the, whatever your intercontinental, either the TNT title or the Atlantic title again, the international title. So, so he would be the second, but then also bring somebody to be like the young boy that takes the pin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see who they add, how they add them to this family. The last point Reverend Keith made, then we'll get to a couple rapid-fire email questions. The next title for Jay White. I mean, to me, in a different world, Jay White was the one to dethrone Orange Cassidy for the international title. If Jay White had come in to AEW a little hotter, I think that could have been the play. Probably wouldn't have been in the main event here on this show, but who knows? Maybe, again, if he had come into AEW a little hotter as a singles wrestler, that may have been possible here. I'm not sure. It kind of feels like tag titles, and because he's still with Juice Robinson, so they I think, somebody mentioned earlier the beneficiary of CM Punk leaving could be Jay White. And so I would agree, because Jay White has been on Collision. He's been a Collision guy. And he could take that mantle from CM Punk. There are some other wrestlers who could benefit from that as well. But, Jay White versus Moxley is interesting for the international title, although I guess Moxley is still a heel probably, and Jay White is as well. Although Bryan Danielson was a babyface against Ricky Starks, and Danielson and Moxley are in the same group. So it kind of depends on the opponent, I think, as to who is a babyface and who is a heel sometimes. But I don't see Jay White really in the mix right away for facing MJF, as interesting as that could be from a personality clash standpoint. But Javier, to you, what do you think about Jay White and the next title, or the first title that he should be after in AEW?
I mean, that is a Good question, because I did think that he was going to eventually be the foil for CM Punk. So, I don't know, maybe you have a tournament and he wins the interim real world title. something, you know, being facetious, but, you know, something along those lines. I do think that he should, you know, just take over Collision. I like the idea of maintaining a soft roster split to maintain it. I know it was kind of forced because CM Punk was involved, but I like the idea of basically maintaining that. So you have some people that are the usual Collision people and the usual Dynamite, but they could jump across as needed. I think that give him the ball and let him run with it, because he's definitely got a presence about him and the way that he does things. And it was funny because talking about the little Eric talked about was the small standees, I'm thinking, man, they could probably make a mint selling Jay White body pillows. They could make a mint selling those.
Card blade. I'm not sure if that would be comfortable sleeping on, but who knows? They could fashion it somehow and make it work. Tony, you know, one thing I'll say, though, is I've really come to enjoy, and I didn't always enjoy it, but I've really come to enjoy Juice Robinson's sort of crazed maniac character. So to a certain extent, I do like the pairing of Jay White and Juice Robinson. So, I mean, what's your take on it? Is there still mileage that you'd like to see them get out of Jay White and Juice Robinson as a tag team before Jay White goes out as a singles, or do you think they've got to move quickly for that?
So I think based on tonight, I think we're either going to get a four-way for the tag titles or with those four teams, or you could even get a rotating feud real quick where Jay and Juice do get one last shot at the tag titles, or, you know, something of that sort. And then I think he does need to get spun off into singles. That doesn't mean you gotta, you know, you can't have Juice and Jay occasionally tag up for something, but you know, but when you circle around to that question, it doesn't, when you say he needs to spin off into a singles, it doesn't mean he immediately needs to challenge for the world title or the international title. Definitely not the TNT title, because I'm going to be honest with you, I love what Christian Cage is doing, and he's entertaining the hell out of me, but I really don't care about that title, and I don't think most people do at this point. Yeah. It's kind of the one that, of all their actual AEW titles, I'm not going to pretend that the Ring of Honor titles exist, but of all those five titles and within AEW on the roster, that TNT title has taken the biggest hit, so I would want to stay away from that title, as far away from that title as possible. Like I said, he's still a main event talent. It doesn't mean you always have to be going for the world title. You could have main event programs without being in the title picture. I think that's what he needs to move on to. And like I said, you could definitely clear up this tag title picture, because I think he's going to be involved with that over the course of the next month or so. But, you know, I'd imagine they're paying him quite a ransom, you know, to get him away from New Japan and keeping him off of WWE's books like they did. So, you know, you might as well get your money's worth. He's probably one of the best talkers they have on the roster. He's one of the better in-ring guys. There's no reason he shouldn't be doing single stuff. And it's almost like the same thing you see when they had Omega bogged down in the trios division for the last 9 months. Well, not all of the last 9 months, but you get what I'm saying. It's kind of a waste of his talent. So he needs to be split off, I'd say, sooner than later. But if you want to wrap up this seemingly four-way thing they have going with the tag titles, I would do that. But and again, like I said, I like his how he gels with Juice as well, and that doesn't mean you got to break them up as a group, but I would definitely split him off sooner than later in the singles.
We go to our email bag for a couple emails here to close things out. This is from Azan. He says, hello, Greg and Tony. Number one, I feel AEW should use ROH people like Shane Taylor and Shibata better and more on regular AEW TV. What do you think? My thought is, sure, use him more on AEW TV, but not as ROH wrestlers. If you're going to use him on AEW TV, don't bring that ROH baggage to AEW television. Make them AEW wrestlers. Put them under AEW contract. We don't need – that was a very down time in AEW's history when they were spending so much time with ROH wrestlers and with ROH titles. I don't want to see a repeat of that. So, Tony, I mean, are there guys that are in ROH or women in ROH that you think Tony Khan should take and say, hey, we could use you on AEW. You're an AEW wrestler now.
Yeah, there's a handful. I mean, and the thing is with that, I don't even care if they show up and also work Ring of Honor. I don't want to see Ring of Honor title feuds on AEW television. It's just – they have five titles as it is. That's more than enough between two television shows. I don't need to see the Ring of Honor television title defended on TV pay-per-views. I don't need to see the Pure title defended, et cetera, et cetera. The ones that I would want to see, you know, whether they're working both or just AEW, that's fine. Shane Taylor is a good example. Athena is a no-brainer. They're starting to finally, it seems like, move the kingdom onto AEW television. I think they're very underutilized. I'm a big fan of them, and I think they're going to be a big part of, you know, the Adam Cole storyline going forward. So I'm happy with that. Shibata, obviously, that name speaks for himself. He's, you know, he's great in ring, and the fans love him. The name's mentioned, and like I said, Athena especially. I mean, if she's going to be the Ring of Honor champion, that's fine. She doesn't need to show up on AEW television with the Ring of Honor title. And I'd say the same for Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe could work both. He could still be the Ring of Honor television champion. He doesn't need to defend that Ring of Honor television championship on AEW television and AEW pay-per-views. There's nothing wrong with them working both, but I don't need it to know that they are holding titles in Ring of Honor. If I want to watch that, I'll watch Ring of Honor television and watch those titles defended there.
Javier, I guess from Tony Khan's point of view, he doesn't want to just completely take all the top talent from ROH and put them on AEW television because he owns ROH and he wants to make that successful and he wants to make that a place where, you know, if you like what Athena's doing because you hear the buzz on social media, then you should watch ROH TV. So, you know, how much of it is sort of a push-pull for Tony Khan? You know, he wants to utilize the best talent he has under contract. The best way to do that is by putting them on AEW, but he doesn't want to completely strip ROH of its talent either.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I'm fine with them using them, but the problem, because that was one of my, I mean, I was going to be snarky when I wrote the primer for All Out. I was going to be snarky and call it, you know, ROH All Out. Cause you had the two title matches and you had, two other matches that furthered ROH storylines. So, you know, so that was, you know, that's four out of your 13 matches because I'm counting the pre-show matches. So, you know, and if we wind the clock back to that time period where they were doing the, that at the same time they were building up an ROH pay-per-view on AEW television, they were building up Forbidden Door on AEW television, where you just had this mess of just, you know, nobody working. The ratings started going down. And after that, Tony Khan said, oh, yeah, we're not going to be seeing these titles defended anymore. We're not going to be seeing these titles anymore on AEW programming, and here we are. You know, we're heading back into that, you know, we're taking steps backwards on that. So yeah, you could use them, but you know, in this pay-per-view, I mean, I love the Kingston Shibata match with Claudio and Yuta, but it's promoting two things: the storyline between Kingston and Claudio, which is going to eventually lead to the ROH is eventually going to pay off in an ROH championship match that Claudio holds. And then there's also the stuff going on between Yuta and Shibata, which is going to be for the Pure ROH Pure title. So you had that match. You had the Taylor Joe match. You had the MJF Cole versus Dark Order match. And then you also had the in the pre-show though, which was essentially my guess is that it's to set up Nightingale and Athena for the ROH women's title. So, you know, it feels like, you know, it felt like a lot of stuff going on today was to promote stuff that's not even going to be paying off or even shouldn't pay off in AEW. Use all this talent. Use Athena, have her go after the TBS title, have her go after something, and then, you know, use ROH as a way to put wrestlers that lose a big title feud, put them in ROH so they can do something to get them off AEW. So essentially go to a new territory and learn a new hold and then come before they come back. That, I think, is the best utilization for ROH. And just rotate, you know, use it to rotate people in and out of what you have, because that's one of the complaints that Tom Martin of The Fix has, is you're not putting matches, you know, on your show of top guys, you know, against each other, because you want to protect everybody. You're just having, you know, the top guy versus someone who's much lower on the card, so it's known who's going to win. Well, have two people that are similarly situated on the card feud. If, you know, to protect the loser, if they lose, send them, you know, they could go to RH, do a thing for, like, you know, a couple of weeks and then come back. That's the best way to handle, you know, in my opinion, best way to handle both ROH and AEW.
And Javier, you know what's funny? Real quick, you know what's funny? Sean Ross Sapp from Fightful reported that if Billy Starks was cleared, you were going to get Athena versus Billy Starks for the Ring of Honor women's title, either on the pre-show or on the main show tonight as well. So that would have been three Ring of Honor titles defended and only two AEW titles defended on an AEW pay-per-view. So if you'd have done the primer as ROH All Out, I would have popped for that big.
Yeah, I do wonder how much of that is extenuating circumstances, because you just had All In, you know, and instead of, you know, turning around and trying to build something new for, you know, in 1 week, you just kind of take some existing ROH feuds and put them on there. So I don't expect this to be the norm going forward, but when you've got back-to-back pay-per-views on back-to-back weekends, I think, you know, it's hopefully the exception. The second question that Azan has for us is, what do you think about Nigel McGuinness on the call tonight? So we didn't hear a lot from Tony Schiavone. Nigel McGuinness was the second man through the entire show, and they had a rotating third man, which is gets to a question that's after Azan's in the mailbag. But Javier, what did you think of Nigel McGuinness's performance tonight?
Overall, I like Nigel McGuinness. The only issue I have with him, which is the same issue I have with Wade Barrett, is sometimes they try to play the heelish role and come up with just like the dumbest stuff, you know, in this, you know, I know they're kind of doing and trying to do in the style of Bobby the Brain Heenan, but they're not Bobby the Brain Heenan. And they have a lot of like intelligent stuff that they say, but then when they try to like stir the pot in the way, cause in this one, it was, he told Ricky, Rick and Dragon Steamboat basically said, how do you feel about Danielson calling himself the American Dragon? None of those words. These are not the words he said. But, you know, essentially he's saying that he calls himself the American Dragon to, you know, as a shot at you not being American even though you are. You know, he was trying, like, really hard to say something like, you know, heelish. And it come out cartoonish. I'm like, just you know, I mean, you could root for the heels, but don't be just, like, really, you know. But that's just like a style thing. But overall, once you take that out of the situation, I like him well enough.
Tony, your thoughts on Nigel McGuinness tonight?
I would largely agree. There are times when Nigel tries to get a little bit too cute, maybe, like you're saying. But I'm a big fan of his. He was on the whole show. He was one of the – it was Excalibur and Nigel, I believe, that were the only two not cycled on and off the show, which is kind of funny because – if we're going to stick with the thing with the announcers here, and I'm glad this was brought up because I wanted to say it at some point. Jason Powell at ProWrestling.net, I don't know how often you guys get to listen to him. I am on the same wavelength with him where, honestly, I would move Excalibur off of Wednesdays. I think Ian Riccaboni should be their main broadcaster for play-by-play. It should be. I think him and Nigel should be on Dynamite as the main show, and I would put Excalibur on Collision, and then if you want to do it with Taz or Shivani, that's fine, but and that's not to put Taz down. I'm actually a fan of his work as well. But Ian Riccoboni is the one I think they're really missing the boat on, and I know Riccoboni didn't want to do Collision because it takes him away from his kids on weekends, but the big solution to that is Dynamite's on Wednesdays. It's not on weekends, and he should be their main play-by-play guy. I think he's the one that it's actually they're missing on the most. And like I said, I know that's something Jason Powell's been opining for, and I'm kind of echoing him on the Torch broadcast here. But like I said, for me, a big fan of Nigel, and it's a shame. I think Ian Riccoboni is something. He could bring a fresh voice to Dynamite. And, of course, that would leave Kevin Kelly as the odd man out. But, you know, he already has a gig with New Japan, so it's not like the guy would be looking for work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Ian Riccoboni as well. I think he does a really nice job. And if they can find a spot for him that is a bigger role than ROH, I think that's good for everybody involved. Azan's final question from the mailbag, how far do you think AEW should go with Konosuke Takeshita? Do you think he can hang in the main event? I mean, he hung with Kenny Omega tonight pretty well, and Kenny Omega's a main eventer, so I'm certain Takeshita can hang in the main event, and I'm pretty sure he's going to get there at some point in the next year. So it's just a matter of when, I think, at this point, Tony. Is Takeshita maybe right now ready for the main event, or do you think he still needs a little bit more time?
I mean, you basically said it. If you can hang with Kenny Omega, you can main event. And the two guys tonight that prove they can hang with main eventers, obviously two completely different types of matches, are Takeshita and Ricky Starks. I mean, the rumor mill is that Starks is just looking to cash in and maybe move on to WWE. He's big fan, you know, he's big close friends with Cody Rhodes. So that may happen also, and that it could be just a primer for him to move on. But I think both of those guys, you know, were made big tonight. I mean, Starks, we've kind of seen it coming for a while. And I think tonight was what really is going to put him on the map. And Takeshita, we've heard about the promise for a while and how he's going to be the next guy also. And I think it was also a cementing moment for him. And I think both of those guys proved tonight that, you know, they can hang with Danielson and Omega. You're ready for the main event.
Javier, are you sold on Takeshita as a main eventer?
Yeah, I think you could put him on there. I mean, that is the story they're telling. He's the new Kenny Omega. So he's not going to be the new Kenny Omega if he doesn't win the main event at some point, so, you know, mm-hmm. if he's not, you know, at the top. So I do think that's the eventual direction for him. And I mean, and he is a, you know, very talented wrestler. His downside obviously is that, you know, unfamiliarity with the language, but you know, in this case is why he has cows with him.
And final question tonight from Ryan from Winnipeg. He says, first time emailing in, just wanted to call out some praise for AEW's directors for making the call to switch out the third man on commentary depending on the match. I think it's made the shows better because you don't have JR on commentary crapping all over a Young Bucks tag match that is often chaotic with little enforcement of the rules. Would you agree that this has enhanced the presentation of their show? I think so. I agree. I think JR can get a little belligerent when he's on there for too long. So I think keeping him in short doses and keeping him, you know, they haven't done this, but I was always of the thought that bring JR out for the main event shows, for the main event matches, for the matches that are the titles or the main event of the pay-per-views, because his voice still carries some cachet. And I think you want that in the main event matches. That being said, the way they used it tonight, where I think they had a different commentator each hour or very close to it. I think JR was the second hour. Taz may have been the third hour, something like that. I thought that worked really well, too. So I was really pleased. They've not really settled on a pay-per-view commentary format, it doesn't feel like. But I think tonight was the closest they got to hitting on it, Javier. What did you think about it tonight?
Yeah, I mean, again, I missed the beginning part of it. I just caught the tail end of JR, and the thing is that, unfortunately, what caught my ear was in the attempt of trying not to sound sexist, he ended up sounding sexist when he was talking about, you know, you know, she's a big woman, but I don't mean that in a, you know, I don't mean that in a whatchamacallit way. And he goes, you know, I'm just saying she's, you know, I called her a linebacker, but I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that, you know, I'm like, dude, you don't have to explain yourself, man. Just go with it. Everybody knows what you're talking about. If someone complains about it, ignore it. I mean, just go. But, you know, that was kind of my problem with him. Was Steamboat on his, Steamboat, there weren't four people in Steamboat, were there, right?
Trying to think.
I don't think so. I think it was just, it was Excalibur, Nigel, and Steamboat. I think he's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I'm remembering that correctly, I like that when you have like a, you're going to have someone like, you know, when Callis jumps on commentary, I do like that idea of not having another, yet another voice, you know, in there. I'm trying to think if Taz was there, because I'm trying to think about the commentary. But yeah, I mean, I do like the fact that they have a rotation there, because it does, by the way, it's something I generally don't like. You know, I would prefer just to hear the same, you know, people throughout the entire thing. But if you have two anchors and then like a third person with like a different like point of view revolving around the match, not someone who's going to get necessarily involved in the match, but I like that idea.
Tony, your thoughts on the commentary tonight and how they split things up?
Yeah, on a pay-per-view, I like the rotation, and they've done this for the last handful of shows, at least, I want to say, where they kind of rotate guys in and out on the pay-per-view, and it's a little hyperbolic, but not too hyperbolic, that they kind of have an embarrassment of riches in terms of wrestling broadcasters now. And that's what I was getting at before. Like, I'd honestly like to see if, and someone could correct me if I'm wrong, I was pretty sure that Excalibur started his career as a broadcaster as kind of the in the color role. And I would prefer to see him go back to that, because I'm not the biggest fan of his play-by-play. So I'm kind of going back on the soapbox I was just on about 5 minutes ago, where if you wanted Excalibur to be one of your color guys on those two shows, you could do that as well. And if you wanted to keep Kevin Kelly as a play-by-play, and you can even move Shivani off into an interviewer role, or Jason Powell said this before, so I am stealing some of his commentary, but I agree with it. They need an on-air authority figure so that they don't always have to reference Tony Khan as this, you know, disembodied voice coming through Tony Schiavone. Just make Tony Schiavone the commissioner of AEW, and it seemed like he would excel in that role. And, you know, they have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to broadcasters, so figuring that all out is probably, you know, not as easy as we like to think it is sitting here, but I mean, Tony Khan has a roster of what, 140 wrestlers, and he has a broadcasting crew of what, 8 to 10 very solid announcers. So, you know, I'm glad he gets to figure that out and not us, but I like that they cycle him through on the pay-per-views, and I would keep that format going indefinitely.
Well, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure tonight. I want to thank both of you for joining me and hanging out late tonight talking about AEW All Out. I'll give you both a chance to plug your work for the Torch for those listeners out there, starting with Tony.
All right. So, I just recently started writing again for the Torch. I'll be doing AEW pay-per-view hits and misses coming out of every AEW pay-per-view. So I have some work to do either tonight or tomorrow morning, so look for that to be up on the site, I would say Monday or Tuesday. I did tell Wade I'm looking to get more involved with some audio, so hopefully that'll happen as well. And then since they're kind of like a cousin website to ours, I don't feel bad about promoting this. Starting this week, I'm also going to be contributing for Jason Powell's ProWrestling.net with a mixed bag column every week or two, or with them as well. So, pretty exciting stuff. I'm going to be contributing to two sites that, you know, between Jason and Wade, they're good friends. They work together on a lot of things. So I'm kind of getting to work with both guys, and it's going to be a lot of fun. You could follow me on social media. I know Greg still calls it Twitter. So the artist formerly known as Twitter, now known as X, and Threads. So let's not forget about Threads for those that are on there as well. My handle's the same on both. It's at Tony Donofrio. That's at TonyDonofrio on X and Threads. But thanks a lot, Greg. I always enjoy coming on here, and it's a blast.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much, Tony, for hopping in. I know it was late notice when I gave you a buzz on it will always be Twitter to me. So that's old habits are hard to break. Javier, go ahead and plug your work for the Torch as well.
Yeah, I do the primers for WWE and AEW pay-per-views. And I'm also, you know, joining here and there in the audio, sometimes doing like a mini roundtable at the end of post shows when I get the chance, or, you know, sometimes co-hosting with Wade. Just, you know, I consider myself like the Ronin of PW Torch. Just, you know, go where I'm needed.
Excellent. And I got to have you on Wrestling Night in America. I got to have you on before you... Go ahead.
Yeah, that was just saying, you can follow me on X at Jay Machado LK. I don't tweet anything out, so you're good with me. I'll give you a courtesy follow. So.
I was going to say, I got to have you on again, because last time I had you on Wrestling Night in America, we did our New Japan G1 prediction. So I got to go back and score us and see how we did, and then make it public on Wrestling Night in America. So I look forward to having you on again where we can talk about that.
Well, I mean, considering the fact that I based everything on a Okada versus what's his name? name is escaping me now. And Renderita going through. Mine was pretty thoroughly screwed.
Well, that's the fun part. That's the fun part of it is checking it out and just seeing how screwed we were. So we'll do that sometime in the near future. Javier, thanks for being on tonight.
All right, have a good one, Greg.
Yep. And thanks, everybody, for listening here tonight. You can catch us each and every Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, unless there's a pay-per-view like there was tonight. PWTorchDailyCast.com. You can email us anytime, WNIALivecast@gmail.com. John, I see your email about payback. We'll get to that next week. Look forward to answering that with another co-host from the Torch family. So you can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks, and we'll talk to you again next Sunday, because if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.